Hey, it's the FinTech Newscast. My name's John, and how are you doing, Steve?
I am doing quite all right. How are you, John?
Good, good. The weather's nice outside. Everything seems bright and shiny. But when I look at the news, it seems like places are getting wiped out with storms. Hurricane Ida is making a bit of a disaster. We have the Caldor fires, which is it Caldor? Is that right?
I think it's Calder, yeah.
Yeah, fires are out near Lake Tahoe. I saw the news thing saying 35,000 structures are in its path. They're having power problems around Louisiana with Ida. The droughts have been pelting the Midwest. As long as if I don't look at the news, I guess everything's fine.
Yeah, it seems like it's a never-ending catastrophe, right? Just a lot of stuff going on. It's funny how usually in the morning before I leave the house, if I go take the kids to school or something, I check the weather, but now I also check the AQI, which is horrendous. Like it's a new thing to add to the list to check the air quality.
Yeah, I haven't thought about that until the last wildfires were nearby. We're in California, and that's getting to be a regular annual thing. And I'm surprised we haven't talked about climate change and these kinds of impacts. It's such a big thing for the world, also for the financial industry. A lot of regulation coming up with that. But fortunately, we have someone finally on the podcast to help talk about those kinds of issues with us. We have Elisa Valderrama, the co-founder and CEO of the appropriately named Future Proof Technologies. How are you doing?
Hi, great to meet you. And yeah, glad to be on the show. I'm doing fine, thanks.
Well, we're certainly glad to have you on. Well, tell us a little bit about Future Proof Technologies and how you guys help mitigate all these climate risks.
Sure. I'm glad to tell you about what we're up to and share a bit about our contribution to the problem that is much larger than any particular company. But so I guess I'll start with just a couple of seconds on myself. I'm an attorney by background, and so from I kind of been have been working on this issue though that Future Proof touches on for all of my career. I would say that I started from a pretty young age. So I grew up in San Diego. I grew up lucky enough to be by the beach and was a surfer growing up. And even as a kid, I was kind of struck and confused that every time it rained in San Diego, the ocean for the next 72 hours would be too polluted to swim or surf. And I thought, well, that's very strange. Clearly, someone somewhere is not getting some form of data or information they need because it doesn't make any financial sense for the city of San Diego to allow that to happen, because the ocean is really the only reason people want to live here, and it's the entire property tax base. I didn't articulate it quite that way when I was just a 13 or 14 year old, but it did occur to me that it was very strange that some decision maker somewhere had thought this was an okay thing to have happen for San Diego. And so that kind of set me off on a lifetime journey to figure out how environmental issues and environmental risk ultimately could be translated into information that was more decision useful. And I think it has been a lifelong journey to figure out exactly what my personal strategy is and then how to make a career out of that. So yeah, I went to law school thinking that maybe there was a regulatory type approach or there's some sort of market institution that I could join that would help to shape rules to surface kind of environmental risks in more financial terms so that folks at City Hall in San Diego or the budget office, obviously I was still thinking local until I was older, but could get the information they needed to do the cost benefit of like how much is it going to cost to invest in improved, urban stormwater management versus the cost of shutting down the beaches for, several days, several weeks ultimately per year. I found that there wasn't really an answer in a regulatory body at the time. And I thought, well, maybe I should just go try and find places where markets and the environment are already working, in tandem in some functional way. And so I kind of took a deep dive into thinking about energy efficiency project finance, which is now, I think, a pretty healthy industry, but effectively it's this notion that a private sector investor could make an investment in a building to make that building more energy efficient, which has the nice benefit of helping the building owner and the investor ultimately potentially save money while also reducing emissions from the building. So it's like, okay, here's a place where, you know, there's a return on investment, and there's that return takes an environmental form as well as a financial form. Great. Did that for a little while at the Natural Resources Defense Council. Eventually figured out there were more smart people and certainly more technical building engineers that were going to take the baton and run with that issue and help turn that into a larger market. And I turned my focus to an area where there hadn't been as much work, which was on distributed urban stormwater management, coming back to my San Diego roots. And again, trying to figure out how we can set policies in place at a local level. And ultimately, again, through my vantage at the NRDC, understand how, you know, an environmental nonprofit organization can kind of help, you know, have that runway to bring together the actors for some kind of pilot transactions that would demonstrate how, you know, there could be a demonstrated return on investment after, you know, putting some cash or capital toward, say, distributed urban stormwater management, and then having, you know, some sort of financial return to those investors, as well as an environmental return in the form of reduction in stormwater pollution. So I kind of decided that I would just focus on understanding where markets were already working in the right way with environmental outcomes. And that was kind of my personal way of working in the ESG space for a long time. And I think that was born out of what was then a frustration, and maybe this still holds, a frustration with, you know, kind of environmental, social, and governance issues generally always being relegated to, you know, sort of sidebar, a glossy report, but never part of the core financial analytics in a major financial institution. So I thought, well, I don't want to be this, you know, glossy report sideshow in ESG world. I want to go out, work on project finance, really try and figure out how we can reimagine market mechanisms to account for environmental benefit and harm in a new way. So that's kind of like the mindset, I would say, that enabled me to put aside my work and jump off the cliff and try and start Future Proof a couple of years ago.
And essentially the value prop here is you guys are able to quantify the effects of climate change on things like property, on mortgages, and use that information to then bring value to the financial services space, right?
Yeah, so I think, you know, climate risk means a lot of things to a lot of people. Broadly speaking, you know, the climate risk analytics universe is divided into two parts. There's transition risk, which you could think about as the risk that certain assets will lose value over time because of, for example, a price on carbon, that type of thing. And then there's physical risk, which is the pure impact of physical risk, you know, in the form of damages to real assets. And so those are the kind of the twin universes of climate risk world. And here at Future Proof, to date, we've focused on the impact of physical climate risk on real assets and trying to really make that translation of, you know, the frequency and the magnitude of a certain peril at a certain location into true dollars and cents, you know, some financial outcome that an investor that's just trying to make a good decision can use in their existing you know, financial decision-making process. So the concept is to create analytics that look and feel just like traditional financial analysis. It just happens to be reflecting a new concept, which is climate risk. So I think that's kind of what we're up to. And we deliberately chose to focus on the impact of physical climate risk on real assets for a start, just because, you know, so I'm an attorney by background. My co-founder, Alex Galber, is an economist, and we really wanted to try and bite off a piece of this very important and large question that we felt we could credibly answer.
So you guys essentially, you're able to identify the risk, but you're not actually telling your customers ways to mitigate the risks, right? It's just sort of, this is the information, do with it as you will.
Well, that's actually a bit of an interesting question because we are able to actually say some interesting things about what to do about the risk as well. So at present, you know, we have a web app and an API that can ingest any address or portfolio of addresses anywhere in the world and spit back out some instantaneous results on, you know, expected average annual losses that pertain to each of those addresses or for the portfolio as a whole. We've also done that for about 50,000 companies. So you can look up a number of securities, and we have their facilities mapped as well. So you can get the kind of comparison of company A to company B in terms of their physical climate risk. And what we're and I would say, taking a step back from that, what we've done with our analytics, which is a bit unique, is that we do take property characteristics into account. And so what we're building now in our app is the capability for users to actually alter the property characteristics and be able to understand in an immediate sense how that would change the average annual loss from, say, flood, if you raise your ground floor elevation by 10 feet or 5 feet. So that's something that we're really excited about, because it's not just about signaling the risk, but I think what we want to try and get to here at Future Proof are the tools that can actually help decision makers make strategic resiliency investments as well. And I think getting back to, you know, my roots at, you know, sort of in energy efficiency and such, you know, you got to show people how it's going to look like from a straight up returns perspective, I think, to really move the needle. And when it comes to climate risk, I think we are actually really geared toward surfacing the risk, but also surfacing potential opportunities to mitigate those risks and help make organizations more resilient.
Are the issues around climate change still being figured out? And the reason I asked that is I just saw this Office of Climate Change and Health Equity mentioning the health effects. And that was kind of a surprise to me. I hadn't thought of climate change in that way. So I had to read up a little bit about that. But is that are those kinds of things you have to constantly keep updating your analytics for?
Yeah, absolutely. I would say that we are constantly kind of going to the cutting edge of what climate science can say about, for example, the probability and the magnitude of, you know, a flood of a certain depth. And, you know, going to the cutting edge of the science in terms of, you know, granularity of those projections. So I would say we're constantly kind of striving to go to the cutting edge on the science, absolutely, in every way.
Yeah, with no historical data, you just kind of have to project forward something that we haven't seen before.
Well, I think there is. So we do also have kind of hindcast data as well. So we, I think, are able to, you know, kind of look backward and forward into, you know, the global climate models. And, you know, on that side of things, science is increasingly, you know, more and more, I would say, compelling. And there's more and more consensus as to, you know, what these different paths look like for the planet. So I would say that's, in some ways, the climate science part is sort of not our biggest concern as a company in terms of, you know, I think that's exciting and a challenge is that we are producing a new form of risk analytics. And that is, I think, news for folks. And that is probably, there's a fair amount of education on that we need to do for markets as well. So it's, I would say on the climate science side, I don't want to sound overconfident. There's obviously a huge, huge amount of work that's being done to advance the state of the art on the science in both public and private sector. I guess what I would say is that we're standing on the shoulders of that work. And that's kind of one of our differentiators, I would say. So a large number of climate risk analytics firms that focus on the physical climate risk are, I think, doing great work on innovating on this sort of, you know, climate science, or what we here at Future Proof would call, you know, the hazard side of the catastrophe model, focusing on frequency and magnitude of a peril, you know, of a certain type in a certain location. And, you know, there's a lot to be done on the science side of the hazard. Where we at Future Proof have decided to focus our energy is really on what's called the vulnerability side of the catastrophe model. Catastrophe models are actually very complex, but broadly speaking, you know, you can think of them as a hazard component and a vulnerability. The hazard being, you know, again, the probability of something happening in a certain location, and the vulnerability kind of translating that hazard into something like an average annual loss. And so we at Future Proof, I would say, are very focused on that vulnerability part of the catastrophe model equation. And that's, for whatever reasons, not been a place where a lot of firms have sort of dared to tread. From our perspective, it was a natural place for us because of my sort of pre-existing interest in the financial impacts of various environmental risks, and then our corporate DNA. You know, two of our four co-founders have PhDs in economics. So we naturally sort of thought about it as, you know, econometricians and economists would think about this in terms of how to build that vulnerability model. Whereas I think a lot of climate risk firms and indeed catastrophe modeling firms have, you know, a lot of science expertise and certainly data science, but maybe a little bit less on the, econometrics and financial side of the equation. So that's a bit about our sort of corporate DNA and where we have chosen to focus our resources, which is, you know, what we call informally the last mile problem, right? How do you jump from, you know, a sort of climate risk score of 0 to 100 or a color-coded chart about climate risk into something that can be incorporated into more of a discounted cash flow model? And that's the part that we emphasize and we focus on.
Or assessing the specific credit risk for a specific exposure. That translation exactly. All the way down, like you were saying, that maybe the broad science is there's more firm grounding, but translating that down into the industry, into the exposure that you're looking at, takes a bit of work.
Absolutely. And yeah, just to kind of add a little bit to what we've done there. So, you know, as I mentioned, we can project, you know, average annual losses for real assets or a portfolio of assets. We can roll that up to a company level. And then on the debt side, we've actually taken those damage projections and, you know, developed the analytical frameworks to translate that into probability of default and loss given default. And ultimately kind of basis points or basis point impacts for debt backed by collateral at whatever address has been entered into our web app or API. And that type of analytic in particular is quite rare. I don't see anyone else having done that or with a team to be able to do it. And that's the kind of analytic that I think, you know, in this environment where there's a lot of excitement and clamor and anxiety around, you know, what's the SEC going to do on regulating banks or on climate risk and climate disclosure? I truly believe that unless, you know, the financial sector is talking about climate risk in financial terms, we're still in the world of, you know, color-coded charts and qualitative assessments. And so I think, you know, something like what we've done on debt is the type of tool that a regulator or a bank will need if they truly want to think about something with a climate stress test, because it has to be about the value at risk and it has to be in financial terms. And so I think this again goes back a bit to our philosophy, but there's a lot at stake if climate continues to kind of reside in the pure ESG world of non-financial data, in the sense that climate risk needs to be translated into financial risk in order for, I think, our society as a whole to be able to contemplate it, you know, understand.
Go beyond the marketing claims a little bit, and beyond, the broad exactly. strokes.
Exactly. Yeah. I think, you know, so I think, anyway, that was a long-winded answer, but we are kind of going to this level of trying to provide the tools that would be helping climate risk to be not really part of ESG, but really it's just risk. It's a new type of risk. And
it's just risk. Yeah. Yeah.
And so I think that's where we are. Yeah.
Right. So I happen to live on an island, you know, maybe 2 blocks from the water or so, and say that in terms of the real world implications of the tech and what you've built here, does that mean that, say, if I want to get a new mortgage and my bank actually uses your services, they may incorporate, you know, sea water levels and sort of flood maps and all that stuff in underwriting my property because I'm so close to the water? I think I may be 3 feet above sea level. But is that the future you see now where you have players in the financial space kind of taking that risk into account and making decisions based on that?
Yeah, it's a great question. And I think it's a complex one because at some level, you know, a lot of that information is already publicly available in a lot of ways. You have nonprofit organizations like, you know, First Street on flood that are just, you know, providing wealth of data to the public. You have, you know, a lot of the residential mortgage brokers starting to incorporate climate risk features in a property lookup. I think Redfin does so, for example, and I believe Realtor.com. So it's not the case that, you know, folks are not already contemplating this or that banks are completely, you know, blind to this either. I think banks are actively, you know, understanding which properties are already in or out of, you know, FEMA flood risk zones. So I would say that we're already there to some degree as a society, but the tools are coarse.
Speaking of tools and the data, I know is there any concern from your part that maybe, you know, because we know that a lot of the people who will suffer through the climate change issues will be those that maybe are not as they may be sort of at a disadvantage. And I'm wondering, will this create information asymmetry so that those who can afford your services will be better off and will be better equipped to deal with, you know, the ongoing climate change, as opposed to those who maybe cannot sort of take advantage of these tools.
Yeah, thanks. That's an extremely important question. And I think part of our mission and DNA is to, you know, try and at some level democratize this information. So for that reason, we've decided to make our tools actually free to financial regulators, for example, because we believe that ultimately it's going to have to be a progression of science as well as policy to ensure that our society collectively, you know, is taking care of itself. And that includes the folks who are most at risk from the impacts of climate. So I think, you know, at Future Proof, we bear that very much in mind as we do our work, and we're trying to find every way we can to help move everyone together at the same time. And I think ultimately we're kind of living in the world where people don't have access to this data, and it's not going so well in terms of decision makers having access to where to make resiliency investments, what the cost benefit looks like. So I would say more information is generally going to be better, more accurate, more precise, more actionable information is generally going to be better, even in terms of giving the policymakers the tools they need to make sure that, you know, those who are most at risk are not further left behind, or who their situation is not going to be substantially worsened. I think they will need tools like Future Proof to be better policymakers going forward into this future where climate change is a part of, you know, everyday news.
Is it frustrating when you see people, more and more people, moving to high risk fire areas or places that are getting more and more at flood risk and this type of thing?
You know, I honestly, it's sort of like the Earth Day type of mentality. Well, I don't know, you know, Earth Day was a big deal when I was growing up. And then at some point someone told me, you know, Earth Day just was very problematic from an environmentalist perspective because it really gave people this idea that, you know, you recycling at home is going to like make a big difference, when in reality, there are huge processes in place in terms of what types of materials get produced cheaply versus not, that happen way upstream from the individual consumer. And those are the levers that need to be pulled. And that's where our focus should really be. So kind of in a similar vein, I don't blame people for making decisions that are rational. They're priced out where they want to be, and they're moving out to, you know, 40 miles away from where they want to be because they can't afford it. And that 40 miles away happens to be the wildland urban interface. You can't blame those people for trying to make a rational decision. I think, again, it goes to this like recycling analogy. You know, policymakers have to have the tools they need to zone differently, et cetera, et cetera. And I do think that is important. So when I see people moving to wildfire zones, I certainly wouldn't blame them. I think there are policy changes that probably need to shape those decisions, and that those policymakers need to have better data.
Well, where do you see the largest gaps between data, the relevant climate data, and good policy?
Good question.
Stumped you.
Maybe everywhere. Maybe it's
so
common.
There's too many.
Yeah, right.
It's I struggle to think of one. It's just, I mean, this is very self-serving, but it really does come down to the translation into financial data for me. I think if policymakers had better data on the financial impacts of climate, things could be very different in terms of policies that get made at every level. You could think about this in terms of, you know, the global climate decision-making, versus, you know, national and regional decision-making. Things could look very different if there was a form of climate risk data that looked and felt like every other form of sort of financial decision-making that folks have at their disposal. I do think that having climate risk data and be in purely scientific or purely qualitative kind of scoring, 0 to 100 type stuff, it just doesn't hit home in the same way as something that's inherently financial. And so this is, again, perhaps an overbroad answer to your question, but I do think that translating climate risk into something more purely financial is truly a way to unlock important strategic decisions being made that will affect us all.
Sure. Well, I'll give you a more specific question then. Who are your typical clients?
Great. So yeah, I think we're really, I think the banking use case is a huge one for us in terms of what I described before. You know, for example, banks that hold whole residential, mortgages on portfolio, they hold these risks already, and they are currently kind of flying blind when it comes to understanding what the impact of, say, a Category 5 hurricane hitting New York City will mean for them.
Mispricing issues
there. Other investors in commercial real estate, I think they do a lot of diligence when it comes to decisions, and they are also by and large flying blind on climate. And if they aren't flying blind, they might be using a qualitative type of tool, but they're not necessarily using analytics that can be incorporated into their discounted cash flow model. So that's what we're offering for them. And I
not just say, red, yellow, green.
Yeah. So I think we're trying to serve those investors that want to, what we say sometimes is, move beyond disclosure and really moving toward, operationalizing climate risk in their investment process. And so I would say, investors like that, although that's where we started, I would say that at this point, private equity funds that invest in companies also have a use for our analytics, since we have a ton of data on securities as well in there, in terms of like being able to search large companies and understanding the footprint of their facilities and the average annual losses for each facility, and then a rolled up kind of average annual loss for the whole company. Some of the numbers we have for some big companies are quite staggering. And I think ultimately there's some interesting information there. And then another kind of emerging area for us outside of traditional investors and asset managers and even banks is really in insurance. And I think that's a huge direction for our company going forward, because it turns out
that makes sense. Yeah.
Once you can project, damages at a property level and taking property characteristics into account, you have a very robust property insurance underwriting model as well. So we kind of inadvertently did some cool stuff on our with our analytical model that is really, I think, turning some heads in the insurance space. So we're really excited to build that out further as well. But to date, to answer your question, we've been selling primarily to asset managers, banks, commercial real estate investors.
Interesting. This new IPCC report from the UN just came out a little bit ago. Was there any new information in there or anything you found surprising?
I am always buoyed by these kind of words that are in the reports that saying, look, things are worse than we thought, but there's still a chance. Mm-hmm. I am always nervous that I'm going to read one of those reports.
I've had lots of girlfriends tell me that before.
I'm always nervous that I'm going to read one of those reports and they're not going to have that little, kernel of hope in there. And so I'm at some level heartened that, there could be a chance to avoid some of the worst effects of climate change still. Truly believe that what we're trying to do here at Future Proof, and there's a whole constellation, I would say, of startups doing really important work on this space that I think can help turn that kernel of hope into maybe even some probability of more hope. And so I feel like the reports are always good to know. And again, a good reminder that we need to work harder on what we're trying to do here at Future Proof. And everyone, I think, should be trying their best to see how they can make a difference.
Do you feel the same way with the upcoming UN climate change conference, this COP26? Queen Elizabeth will be there, Greta Thunberg, President Biden. Do you see that more as some hope or more like an Earth Day thing?
Look, it's a necessity. I wouldn't put it in the Earth Day sort of like confusing messaging. I do think heads of state and visionaries like Greta Thunberg are important, in terms of helping turn the wheels of decision makers and commerce. And I think we need all of it. At this point, I think we need all of those meetings to happen. We need them to go well. And ultimately, I think, we need capital markets to kind of wake up too. So I feel like always glad to see global leaders getting together and talking about how to move forward. And every time a Greta Thunberg opens her mouth, I am delighted, because I think
she's great. Yeah.
Speaks from such a place of, she's so compelling, right? It's like, wow. And she's, now a teenager, I don't know how old she is, but like, it's so true what she says in terms of, just feeling outraged and let down by her elders. It's just a gut punch.
It is, and I think that awareness that events like the ones that John mentioned also help. But there's also kind of a growing consensus among consumers that they mostly want to work really with companies that take climate into account in their products. So I saw recently that there was a new report, I think, that looked at banking customers specifically, and 6 out of 10 of them want their banks to do something on climate, whether that be issuing cards that are made from renewable sources, or just, you know, maybe like some sort of plant a tree thing. But it seems like the whole idea of taking climate change very seriously is really has become embedded in the way in which we do business across all sectors. So there's something that I think is worth being positive about.
Yeah, Challenger Bank aspiration has kind of wrapped itself around the ESG and climate friendly. I think they plant a new tree for every new client they get.
I think that's the one, yeah.
Oh yeah, there are all kinds of cool banks, I think, in trying to do something neat around climate. And it's funny what you were just saying. I do think maybe my Earth Day analogy is a little outmoded, because I think, you know, technology and whatever, the general connectivity of the world has made it such that consumers have a voice now that is, I would say, more evolved from, you know, the 1990s, where it really was just like, okay, you know, I'm recycling on my own. And I don't feel like I have a lot of power as a person to change decision-making at mm-hmm. you know, the company that very inefficiently, you know, packaged this in 3 layers of plastic. I do actually have a hope that sort of, you know, the consumer movement is going to have an impact. And actually, in some places, it's pretty concrete. There was some litigation in Australia last year where pension beneficiaries, I think, successfully sued their pension for not taking climate into account in their investment decision-making in terms of a breach of fiduciary duty. And so I think, again, to me, this all comes back to this issue of, you know, financial value at risk, and ultimately, to put it, come back to the legal world and fiduciary risk, you know, and materiality. How is a bank supposed to know whether its exposure to a Cat 5 hurricane for New York, its New York loan book is material or not? That's inherently a financial, you know, a financial topic. And I think, you know, once we provide, you know, investors and decision makers with analytics that can help them understand the materiality of a particular climate event or in the future, that's really going to help move the needle in a way that, you know, has not to date been very possible.
Do you see the enforcement against greenwashing? Deutsche Bank's asset management division just got in trouble for this, or they're being investigated. And I think we were mentioning new rules coming down the pike. Gary Gensler has mentioned this, and I think there's a new task force there, along with the Justice Department. Is that driving business your way as well?
Yeah, I believe it absolutely is, and will continue to. And I would just say that, you know, when I graduated law school in 2007, and I did a master's in law as well. And my master's thesis was on exactly this question of whether a sort of misstatement to the market around sustainability could be the case for sort of securities fraud action under Section 10b-5 of the Securities and Exchange Act. And I sort of went through all the prongs of the 10b-5 case in terms of, you know, kind of corporate misstatements around sustainability or human rights. And it's funny, because back then, one of the elements that was missing for the cause of action, and for any lawyers listening, I'm sorry for jumbling this, it's been a while, but one of the elements that was tough is there had to be a financial loss as a result of the misstatement. The investor had to show a loss. And so one of the challenges to actually carrying out this legal strategy was that at the time, even when it was revealed that, say, you know, company X had child slaves in its like supply chain or whatever the thing, you know, after saying they didn't, or that they were doing all kinds of things to help, you know, whatever they're supposed to be doing, there wasn't at that point in time much financial impact on the company once the misstatement, you know, was contradicted by some fact finding. And I think that's changed now. I do think, you know, when people find out that companies maybe aren't doing what they say on the environment, you know, it will increasingly have an impact on share price. And so I think maybe it's worth dusting off my old thesis and handing it to some attorneys, but maybe there are attorneys that are already all over that. But anyway, going back to just early days of my career, at the time, I couldn't
find it. It's definitely evolving and changing, sure.
Yeah, I think things are really evolving, and I can't pretend I've kept up with the case law on that, but it is a topic that was of extreme interest to me back in the day when I was trying to think about, again, going back to this core question of how do we translate environmental harm or benefit into something more purely financial.
So you're pretty new company, just over 2 years old. So what is the future for Future Proof? Where do you see the company in 2 or 3 years? Not underwater, hopefully.
I guess I would be in a position to know that from a technical perspective, if our corporate headquarters is going to be at risk for flood. We're not. But no, I really am excited about, kind of getting embedded into some of the fundamentals of financial decision-making and, finding ways to mainstream our analytics. I'd love to see, some of these financial regulators really start to get a grasp on the financial impacts of climate from a regulatory perspective. I think on the insurance side, I believe we'll be a few years from now busy underwriting property insurance and scaling up, let's say, the climate smart insurer of the future. So I would say those are sort of some of the exciting things that I foresee for us.
Yeah, good luck with that. Definitely. We'd love to see you continue to do well by doing good. Thanks for joining us on the podcast.
Yeah, delighted to join. And look forward to continue to listen to your podcast. So thank you.
Yeah, great. Oh, you must be that one listener. Thank you. Appreciate that. That's Elisa Valderrama, the co-founder and CEO at Future Proof Technologies. Please subscribe to keep up with the latest in fintech news. And thank you for listening.